Hello and welcome to the AFPAC File, a joint bi-weekly podcast of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and the Wilson Center focusing on Pakistan and Afghanistan. I'm Mohammed Tahir, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's media manager for South and Central Asia in Washington, D.C. Over the past 2 weeks, one case has been dominating all the headlines in Pakistan, the acquittal of Asia Bibi, a Christian woman who spent 8 years on death row after being falsely accused of insulting the Prophet Muhammad. Blasphemy carries death penalty in Pakistan, but the court ruling on October 31st says that her accusers had not conclusively proved her guilt. Subsequently, she was let go, and this decision led to mass protests in Pakistan by the hardliners. For days, the protests have paralyzed the day-to-day life in most of the major cities until the authorities have reached a compromise agreement with protesters. But this move has raised questions on many levels, including accusations by many that state has surrendered to radicals. Now, as the part of the agreement, Asia Bibi's acquittal case is under review by a second court. So what is next for her? What does the agreement with the hardliners say about the future of blasphemy allegations? What are the possible implications of all this noise for Pakistan? To discuss all these, I'm joined by Meher Tarar, journalist and pro-government commentator based in Lahore in Pakistan, Madiha Afzal, author of the recent book called Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society and the State. Madiha is also a fellow at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Ahmed Shah Azami is joining us from Prague, who's the editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Radio Mashal, which focuses on Pakistan's Pashto-speaking tribal regions, and Michael Kugelman, senior fellow and deputy director of the Wilson Center's South Asia program, is with us from Washington, D.C. Colleagues, welcome on board.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Great to be here.
Very nice to have you. So perhaps this is not going to be news for those who have been following this case. But just to refresh our memories, let's start with this. How did this Asia Bibi case started? Give us, Madiha, some timelines on whys and whats of her case.
So Asia Bibi was a poor Christian woman who was working in the fields in her village in Punjab. And the dispute and the accusation of blasphemy against her really began with the drinking of some water. So she drank water from a cup and then passed it on to Muslim women who were working alongside her in the field. They argued that the water was unclean because a Christian woman had drunk from it. Sure. And so there was some discussion that ensued, and they accused her of having committed blasphemy against the Prophet. And in Pakistan, blasphemy against the Prophet is punishable by death. And so she was charged with blasphemy, put on death row for it. And in 2010, Salman Taseer, then the governor of Punjab, took notice of her case and really began sort of a campaign to have her acquitted, have her removed from death row. And he went further than that. He actually argued for a reform of the blasphemy law. Shehbaz Bhatti, the Minister of Minorities at that time in the PPP government, also took notice of the case. And unfortunately, in 2011, within months of each other, both were assassinated. Salman Taseer, as we know, by his own bodyguard, and Shehbaz Bhatti while he was traveling in his car. Any reform of the law, basically, you know, after these two assassinations, basically was stalled. And since then, we have seen the blasphemy issue weaponized, of course, with the rise of the TLP party in response to Mumtaz Qadri's hanging in 2016. So I'm sure we'll talk much more about it. But Asia Bibi, really, the Asia Bibi case in some ways is really the foundation for how sort of incendiary the issue has become.
Yeah. After that, she stays in the strict condition in jail for 8 years. And now Supreme Court finds accusation against her not accurate, and she gets released. And this brings us to today. So Meher, you are in Punjab and Lahore, where all this has started. What's the latest? What is going on as we speak with the protesters?
Nothing really, honestly. I mean, I read it on Twitter that there were going to be protests, and I have not heard of anything. I've not read about anything. I don't watch television, but, you know, I follow a lot of journalists on Twitter, and I don't think there has been any protest anywhere in Pakistan.
Oh, okay.
You see, it's not about religion. It's about staying relevant. It's how these people remain relevant. They don't get votes. Yeah. They are not in parliament. They don't really have any power, but they... Imagine it's the Muslim country. 97-98% of Pakistanis are Muslim. So there shouldn't really be any paranoia. There shouldn't really be any vigilantes, any guardians of religion. You know, there shouldn't be any fear of anybody belonging to any other religion than Islam. You know, the word minority. But there is. It has been hyped up. There aren't any Christians or Hindus or Parsis or anybody around us. For instance, you know, I live in Lahore, and I say it with a lot of pain that I've never met a single Hindu while living in Lahore. Of course, there are Hindus still living here, but I have never met anyone. So that means they keep to themselves. They keep within their own community. And now, when I was in college, I had, you know, Christian teachers, Christian friends, but that was in the 80s, and then all of them kind of disappeared. They left for other countries, and I think that it is absolutely unfortunate the way anybody who's not a Muslim or is considered the wrong kind of Muslim, you know, like how Pakistan treats MPs.
I hear you, Meher, really. But it's also fact that this is increasingly becoming an issue in Pakistan. Whenever an allegation is raised like that, it creates lots of reactions. So, Ahmed Shah, so what kind of reactions are you getting from Pakistan? It's been already a couple of weeks since she is out from jail, and reactions continues from various groups, parties, and people of influence.
Thank you, Tahir. The reaction is quite serious, but I will say it is a violent reaction from all religious parties and religious groups, despite their ideological and sectarian differences. They came on the same page in this issue, and they all demanded the government to execute the Christian woman Asia Bibi and not let her go out of the country. So this raised concerns among the society that the segments of Pakistani population are extremists. And on the other hand, the government surrendered once again in front of the Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan, who was in the front line during these protests. So they all came on the same page, and the reaction was quite violent, I would say, in this sense. And secondly, it also encouraged the public that they can use this blasphemy law to settle their disputes against the persons. Because when the Mashal Khan case arose last year in April, he was killed as innocent by the mob in front of Abdul Wali Khan University, Mardan, in northwest Pakistan. The people showed sympathies, and they came out on the streets, the civil society, the political organizations, the secular and the liberal forces, they came out. So the people thought that maybe there will be some changes in the blasphemy law, or there might be some amendments in the blasphemy law. The public reaction might be a little bit mild or soft in the blasphemy cases. But when this happened this year, last month, so again, it shows concerns that the society is still going the extreme way, and they are not accepting changes in the blasphemy law. Not only the society, but also the political organizations or the political parties are not daring to speak up.
That's
against
another big question that we would like to talk about. Yes, Ahmed Shah, thank you very much. And Michael, also let me add this. I found a local press's reaction kind of surprising in this. I saw a number of headlines in a major newspapers falsely reporting about the departure of Asia Bibi from the country after the court decision. It was purely false news, putting fuel on fire in a way. So how do you read this? Was it the work of a misinformed people, or there were something bigger at play here?
Well, thanks, Mohammed. It's great to be doing this latest edition of this joint podcast series with you and the others. To clarify, as I understand it, it was actually the BBC. It wasn't a local press in Pakistan. It was the BBC that reported that Asia Bibi had left the country. And in fact, you know, I was getting media requests from the BBC to react to that. And I think that goes to show that it, you know, this is such a delicate and a really an explosive issue that, you know, the fact that you had a very reputable news outlet, BBC, come out with that story, which of course it had to retract because she's still there.
Yeah, I didn't know about the BBC, but I have seen like Express, which is one of the major newspapers in Pakistan, and a couple of others that I don't recall the name. Yeah, could be. BBC,
they, I mean, they were picking up on the BBC story, but you know, getting back to the initial points here that were made, you know, I think another interesting thing here is how this whole thing has evolved. You know, of course, when the Supreme Court announced the acquittal of Azia Bibi, you had the protesters come into the streets. But then, you know, soon after the protesters were in the streets, you had Imran Khan, Prime Minister Imran Khan, who made an address to the nation, which was very striking in many ways. You know, he came down very hard on the protesters, and he basically said, well, please stop threatening the state. Please stop threatening violence. You don't want us to have to use the weight of the state on you. And a lot of folks, including critics of the prime minister, were actually quite encouraged by that, you know, thinking that that would mean that this would be a case where the state would not simply, you know, give in to these characters. But of course, as we know what happened, there was an agreement. I'm not sure at this point that I would say that the government fully capitulated to the TLP, but at the end of the day, there was an agreement that prevented her from leaving the country. But it brings to mind the question, why did he make that speech if there was no intention to actually follow through in the way that he suggested he would? I think it's a useful point for discussion.
Yeah, but let me counter your argument. You know, if you talk to the authorities there, the reason why he did what he did in terms of the agreement is just they wanted to avoid bloodshed. So shouldn't that be one reason to do that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And very briefly, given the legacy of the Red Mosque incident, which I think we all know, and Pervez Musharraf, when he was the president of the country in 2007, he authorized a military operation on these religious students in the Red Mosque, and it had all types of horrific implications and consequences. And I think this is not going to be a case. You wouldn't want a case in Pakistan where you would have a violent crackdown on protesters like these. It could be very inflammatory.
If I can just quickly add on the violence, I mean, the government, as well as the military, as well as supporters of the PTI, argue that, you know, the agreement had to be signed in order to prevent bloodshed, and then there's an ensuing crackdown. But what is important to remember is that these are people out on the streets, not barricaded inside a madrasa. And so it's not a raid. If you arrest protesters out on the street, you can actually, you know, Pakistan has the police forces and has the security forces to be able to undertake large-scale arrests of people without bloodshed. Nobody's asking anyone to fire into the crowd. So I think there's also a sense of partly, I mean, I understand the risks are acute, but there's partly a sense of using the Red Mosque incident as an excuse, in my view.
And also, what I was thinking is, like, you know, maybe they have reasons to do this, like, you know, avoiding bloodshed might be one reason. But again, that decision also, many say, that kind of emboldened those radicals. It should be cause for concern.
Look, you have to look at the bigger picture. Pakistan is, you know, the new government has just come in, and Pakistan was on the precipice of an economic disaster. Pakistan is not just a normal, developed, first world country where, you know, something huge, or there are riots, or there's chaos, that it can deal with it and come out of it without damaging itself even more. The prime minister is going to Saudi Arabia and then to China to ask them to help. And here, I mean, especially if look at it in the context of China, for instance. China is a country that is not religious at all, and the prime minister is there telling them, asking them to help. And here there are, you know, these are all people out on the streets damaging property and doing harm to people and things and personal property and state property and jamming roads and doing everything that is not just good for Pakistan, but it also makes Pakistan look horrible internationally. Pakistan cannot afford to look like that at all. But Yeah, if you do anything to these people, and honestly, without going into details, I have been told by people who were taking action against protesters and their leaders that a lot is being done. They are not publicizing it. They are not telling people about it. They are not even letting media in on what they are doing, but they are doing things. I think what they are trying to do is to hit them where it actually hurts, you know, for instance, they know there that if they arrest Khadim Hussain Rizvi right now, he'll become a hero and there will be protests all over Pakistan. They are trying to avoid that, but trust me, I have been told that action is being taken. The other thing is, this was the time when the religious organizations of Pakistan could have done a lot of good. But because the dismissal of a sentence is not the result of an appeal of mercy presented by a convicted accused. The appeal was for a review of the case, and the bench that included the Chief Justice of Pakistan, Saqib Nisar, decided after a thorough study of the case that Asia Bibi was not guilty of blasphemy. I mean, the reaction in an almost 97% Muslim Pakistan should have been that of joy. That a Christian woman accused of blasphemy of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, had been found after a thorough review by the highest court of the land to be not guilty. The indoctrination and conditioning is so absolute that they have distorted everything that Islam stands for. There is no worldly punishment for blasphemy as far as the Quran is concerned, and that is the main source of guidance for Muslims. So instead, I mean, just imagine a punishment that has no place in the Quran has become so legitimized in Pakistan that it is used so openly by people who are taking Allah's name and Muhammad, peace be upon him's name, and using it to create anarchy in the country. There is Muslim to begin with. So it's all a big mess. And I don't think that there is any short-term solution. I call it capitulation, but I don't think anybody should ever agree to any of the demands of these people. But then on the other end, being realistic, I understand Pakistan is in a very strangely weak position internally and externally, and the government had to do what it had to do. I'm not happy about it, but I understand why it was done.
Okay.
But if I can just add a couple of sort of statistics to sort of Meher's point on attitudes and people's indoctrination, the blasphemy laws, the reason why people are indoctrinated and believe so firmly in the blasphemy laws are because they're part of Pakistan's penal code, and the law doesn't tell you what kind of offense is considered blasphemy. It just says any offense by innuendo, by insinuation. You know, it's sort of a vague blanket set of offenses that can be interpreted subjectively by individuals, and that's punishable by imprisonment for life or by death. And if you look at the attitudes of regular people, in statistics I cite in my book, from polls done in Pakistan over the last few years, 75% of those polled say that they believe that the blasphemy laws are necessary to protect Islam in Pakistan. And 75% also say that they believe that apostasy should be punishable by death. Now, you know, again, in a country where the law says so, where the penal code says so, obviously people might be fearful when asked a question about the blasphemy law. And so they might overstate their belief in the blasphemy law. But this is a matter of the population internalizing the law as it is written.
Thank you, Madiha. We really needed this explanation. I didn't know how to react to Mehri's theological points here. So let's agree to disagree on the handling of the government of this case. Now, when I hear all these discussions around blasphemy once again and the reaction coming out from various cities in Pakistan against the court decision, this makes me to think that, this Tehreek-e-Labbaik Pakistan seems to be the driving force behind all this. But is this really only this party, or there is a bigger support base in this all opposition? Who wants to take this question? Michael, maybe you?
Well, I mean, clearly TLP has been, the main leader in these most recent protests. And I think if you look at recent developments in Pakistan over the last year, it's really been the Islamist party that's been out there on the streets up front in a lot of cases. I mean, we remember what happened a few months ago during the first few weeks of this current government's rule, when the government basically had to backtrack on a decision to invite Atif Mian, a very prominent Pakistani economist, to join a new economic advisory commission simply because he was an Ahmadi. And it was the TLP that didn't even need to go into the streets. They simply applied pressure, as I understand it, and then the government had to back away. And then about a year ago, it was the TLP that led this sit-in in or outside of Islamabad in opposition to a change that the law minister of the then PMLN-led government in Pakistan had put in place, which is something that has to, an oath that has to be uttered by new parliamentarians in Pakistan. So certainly TLP is not the only one. And you look at some of the trends in politics in Pakistan over the last year or so, there have been several new political parties. I mean, TLP is a new party. It hasn't been around for decades. It's new. Several new parties that have come out. You know, another one is the Millî Muslim League, which is a new Islamist political party that has links to the Lashkar-e-Taiba terrorist organization. You know, several of these parties came out, were established several months before the election. Several of them ran in the election. And I think that, you know, some argue that this is really an effort on the part of certain powers that be to sort of steer some of these hardline groups away from violence by encouraging them to participate in the political mainstream. Now, whether that is something that could work is another thing. But to answer your question, I do see the TLP as the ringleader in this case, and particularly in terms of the protest after the Supreme Court verdict on Bibi. But no, it's not the only one at all, but I think it certainly is the most prominent one, and it certainly has perhaps the most mobilization, most clout in terms of mobilizing, getting people out on the streets. But I do think we have to see the TLP as just one player in a broader constellation of parties like this one.
Okay. Now that the things seems to be relatively calm compared to the couple of weeks ago, but Bibi's case is under review by a second court, but her life, her fate remain hanging in the balance, though she is under government protection, but it is short-term strategy. So what is the plan for long-term solution? And more importantly, what is the implication of all this for Pakistan? We will continue the discussion talking about these and many other questions shortly. First, let me recap the debate today on the AFPAC File podcast. I'm joined by Meher Tarar, a journalist and pro-government commentator based in Lahore, Pakistan. Madiha Afzal, author of the recent book called Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society and the State. Ahmed Shah Azami, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's Radio Mashal, which focuses on Pakistan's tribal region. And Michael Kugelman, senior fellow and deputy director of the Wilson Center's South Asia program. I'm Mohammed Tahir, host of the AFPAC File, our joint podcast with the Wilson Center, also based in Washington, D.C. And we are discussing recent wave of protests in Pakistan over the case of Asia Bibi. So Asia Bibi is reportedly in the safe house under government control, and radicals are still calling for her murder. Now, maybe, Madiha, we can start with you now. What's next for her?
You know, I think for the time being, until the furor dies down, you know, while she is free, she's not in prison. She is effectively going to have to be under very, very tight security in Pakistan. I mean, I do want to go back to Imran Khan's speech, the stance this government has taken, and talk a little bit long term, and then perhaps tie it back to the future for Asia Bibi. So I think that Imran Khan, in the speech that he gave on October 31st after Asia Bibi's acquittal by the Supreme Court, a monumental decision, it has to be said, by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court similarly made a monumental decision when it upheld the charges against Mumtaz Qadri in 2015. So Pakistan's Supreme Court has shown courage repeatedly, but Pakistan's leaders have not always sort of risen to their role and articulated clearly a narrative and claimed the narrative when it comes to the law, right? And laying down the law in Pakistan. So in the past, when the TLP has engaged in protests, for example, we have really seen, you know, at that point, the PMLN government really sort of stand back And, you know, of course, it was towards the end of its tenure and it was not doing well politically. And so it had other pressures. Whereas Imran Khan really sort of went on the offensive, really framed the judgment in Islamic terms, right? Which one has to do because Pakistan is, after all, an Islamic state, claimed the narrative in a way that wrests it away from the TLP. So I think he did a very good job that way. And he also claimed that the TLP was hurting the cause of, you know, economic betterment of Pakistan, right? So again, I think this is key. And I think if he can sort of stick to that narrative, I mean, the fact is that the capitulation that has happened this time, while again, I think it's appeasement before a crackdown, and so it's problematic. The fact is that there is a crackdown happening and the narrative was commanded well. So long term, if the government can even just stay on this track, I think it will have moved the needle on this issue. And if so, then, you know, I think once the furor dies down, if Imran Khan can continue to sort of keep the narrative going, perhaps Asia Bibi can actually be let free. Perhaps she can be allowed to seek asylum somewhere else. I mean, I don't put that past matters. But Pakistan has a way of, you know, going one step forward and one step back. And so we'll have to really wait and see what happens. But I do see, I'm cautiously optimistic right now.
Yeah, but in immediate future, what's going to happen to her? Like now her case seems to be under review by the second court. What if the court ruling again comes out in favor of Asia? Then what?
Look, as far as Asia Bibi is concerned, I have not even talked about her after her release. I have written article after article on what happened to her, but I have not talked about it because I think the more people talk about it in media and the more it's talked about on Twitter, because I mean in electronic media you won't really see a lot of debates on this issue. In all probability, she's not even in Pakistan. They are not going to tell, nobody will tell you the truth about her, but let me say this to you, and Supreme Court has done what Supreme Court has done. They are not going to take the verdict back. I'm 100% certain about that, because they knew what the backlash was going to be. They still did what they Mumtaz Qadriya, the person who assassinated Salman Taseer, and now Asia Bibi, who has been released by the Supreme Court. What I would like to add here is that it's not the religious organizations, because despite the fact Pakistan is an Islam, and people like to tell themselves that it was established in the name of Islam. If you talk to normal, regular Pakistanis, they are not very people at all. People you see, the pictures you see, and the amount of influence they have. I'm not saying it's exaggerated. They are a minority, but they create a lot of noise and they create a lot of chaos whenever they unleash their emotional stuff for whatever reason. I'm concerned about is that, yeah, these extremist elements are nurtured, enabled, and promoted in the name of religion, and they find no electoral success, but they still manage to keep their influence on a huge segment of society through exploitation of religious sentiments. And one thing that happens, all governments in Pakistan in the last at least, you know, 50 years are responsible for making these fringe elements mainstream, while the military establishment is alleged to be the creator and main benefactor of most of these organizations.
The problem is all
political leaders indulge in appeasement. All of them capitulate, because all of them, now when Michael was talking about Arif Mia's case, it wasn't just the religious organizations, it was, you know, political parties of Pakistan who were, you know, like very happy that Amir was saying that this MD should not be allowed to come to Pakistan to work. The condemnation came against Imran Khan's decision, but the Prime Minister's decision to include him in the advisory committee came from People's Party. It came from PMLN, from mainstream leaders. It's not just the religious parties. Religious parties exist, but they only exist because these all political parties, I'm saying all political parties, all of them use them, they exploit them.
I understand all this, Meher. But we don't have representation from PPP or PMNL to argue against you. But the question is, now whatever the situation is, the whatever mess we are faced today because of this long-standing issue, it's not the creation of PTI, let me say that, but this is a long-standing issue. But the situation come to this point, now Imran Khan, Prime Minister Imran Khan, has to deal with it. So if again, the court decision comes in favor of RCBB. How Imran Khan is going to deal with that now? What's the strategy there?
He has even tweeted about it, that she has all the constitutional rights or any other Pakistani has. The fact that he's still talking about Asia Bibi, they are still giving statements about Asia Bibi. And as I said, the fact that they are not saying too much is simply to keep her out of the news. Because it was very obvious to everybody, the court and the government and all of us who've been writing or tweeting or speaking up or protesting about her death sentence, all of us knew that there was going to be a backlash, but it happened. So I'm certain that either she has left the country or she will be leaving the country very soon. I have no doubt about that. And whatever they are going to do, you know, it will be exactly like how they reacted after Mumtaz Qadri's hanging. Nobody thought something like that could happen in Pakistan, but it happened. They hanged him. And then they dealt with whatever happened later. And that's exactly what's going to happen.
The dealing with whatever happened later is also very significant, right? And so I would argue that the government dealt quite badly in 2016 with what happened after Mumtaz Qadri's hanging. And that emboldened the TLP. So the backlash and the dealing with the backlash is as important as the decision. And in some ways, I think it's been done better this time around. I mean, I and whether it is because the TLP protesters the TLP leadership went after the judiciary, the government and the army in sort of crude and threatening terms, or whether it's because the army and the PTI are more on the same page than the PMLN and the army were, I actually think that this is maybe not a full step forward, but a little bit of a step forward relative to what has been happening the last 2 years.
Okay, so amidst all these noise, one bigger question is, although we agree that support for blasphemy law might not be widespread in Pakistan, even if the marginal part of the society is pushing for it, this is an issue. It reached to the point that it looks like talking about this issue become so dangerous. And this is a worrying part. We know that earlier, I think one of you mentioned the sitting governor, Salman Taseer, was killed for defending Bibi. I think sitting minister, I think Madiha, you were talking about, the minister was murdered in a similar accusation. So Bibi's lawyer has escaped. And those who committed the crime turned into a hero in the country, like the Qadri. Yeah. So is this kind of getting out of control? I mean, although it's just the support base is just marginal, but point that it has reached.
I would argue that the support base, maybe the number of extremists are marginal, but I would argue that the data that I gave just shows the fact that 3/4 of Pakistanis, when asked a question, you know, these are publicly expressed views, when asked a question about blasphemy, when asked a question about apostasy, they support the blasphemy law, they as necessary to protect Islam in Pakistan. And again, as I said, they think apostasy should be punishable by death, which is akin to the punishment for blasphemy. And so I think that both the education, and this is sort of the argument I make in my book, that both the combination of the education system, the law, and the education system that fundamentally indoctrinates people in thinking that Pakistan is an Islamic country and that it is necessary to protect Islam in the country. That is what the country is for. It is in Pakistan studies textbooks that the majority of students are studying. These are not textbooks in madrasas. These are textbooks in the metric curriculum. That has been internalized, indoctrinated. Then we have the law. And then we have political parties. You know, when Salman Taseer was assassinated by Mumtaz Qadri, Fazlur Rahman, who's a mainstream Islamist politician, was able to go out on TV and defend Mumtaz Qadri, right? And then people were people went on TV, again, mainstream Islamist politicians basically saying to argue for reform of the blasphemy law, maybe akin to undertaking blasphemy itself. So this is an issue that has actually snowballed now out of control, and it is very, very difficult to undertake any reform.
I absolutely agree with her that it has reached a point that you can't even talk about it. I have been writing on the blasphemy law and the need to have reform in it, or even to repeal it. I have written about it while living in Pakistan for Pakistani newspapers. But the point, but the thing is, you have to be very careful how you word your argument, what you say when you're talking about the blasphemy law. So what I've been trying to do is I am trying to tell people what Islam actually stands for, vis-a-vis blasphemy, the allegation of blasphemy. This is what I've been trying. What I would hope for in the long run is that it is very, very hard. I don't think any government in the next probably 100 years would be able to repeal the law. But what they can do is at least tell people that what they are defending is, it's the incorrect premise that they are defending. There is no punishment for blasphemy. This will be a long-term thing. This will only come from the religious scholars. Somebody like Javed Ahmed Ghamdi, who spoke after the assassination of Salman Taseer, he was forced to leave the country. He said it very clearly that this law has no ground, but that this is not an Islamic law.
Yeah.
This time I noticed that a couple of like Jamaatul Dawa, one of those organizations that I don't even like to mention, even they said that they supported the verdict. So even if it's small, even if it's tiny, for people like us who live here and who are going to live here, we really hope that this will change, because so many horrific things have happened in you are using this law. What happened to a poor couple in Punjab a couple of years ago, Shama and Shahzad, they were tortured, they were lynched, there were like 1,000 people killed them, they were thrown in fire. Then what happened to Mashal Khan in Mardan in 2017, and what happened in Joseph Colony in 2013?
So there
are a number of incidents. You see, if it was only about the law, but then there are laws telling people not to do certain things, but they are still doing those things. But it's just that religion is used to do many, many things. Now, for instance, that Joseph Colony incident where a number of houses, 230 houses were burned. Later on, they found out that it was about something else. I mean, it was a fight over booze. It was a fight about liquor. And a number of these issues are about something else. But they know that if they utter the word blasphemy, then there would be nationwide support. And that doesn't just come from religious organizations. Whenever I've tweeted about any of these things, the kind of remarks and comments I get from people around me, it's very, very disturbing.
Yeah.
There are many people who believe that it's justified.
Yeah, let's see what kind of response we are going to get, Michael, from when we post this on Twitter. Let's see. I agree, Meher, with you, and let me pull Michael into this discussion. So talking about this become really dangerous, but also you cannot afford letting the country slide into that corner. So something has to be done about it. But who can do anything better than Imran Khan about this, because he has such a support base and army appears to be working nicely with Imran Khan? So what's the strategy for him? Or what strategy you think Imran Khan should pursue in addressing this issue?
Well, I mean, he's going to have to undertake a very delicate dance between his own desire, in my belief, to try to not let this blasphemy issue get the worst of the country. But at the same time, he's going to have to be careful not to fire up the hardliners, because he knows how powerful they can be in the street. We've seen that so often in recent months. I do think, just to add a bit of nuance to this discussion, it's true that you really cannot have open public debates about blasphemy issues in Pakistan, and it's very hard to have any forward movement in reforming the blasphemy laws if you can't even have an honest discussion about them. But there is some very encouraging work that's been done. It doesn't get as much attention as it should, and perhaps that's for a reason. But you know, you have some of these Pakistani NGOs, and one comes to mind in particular. It's called Engage Pakistan, which has recently come out with this report, that a very in-depth report that basically uses Islamic teachings to argue that the blasphemy laws and executing people on blasphemy allegations are, you know, go against the teachings you come across in religious scripture. This is extremely sensitive and controversial stuff to say and to write on, but it is out there and it's public now. So I think that's something that maybe you have to look to, not necessarily to the state or to the government, but to those in civil society who, of course, face all types of challenges in Pakistan as it is, and particularly if they're going to engage one of the most explosive and controversial issues one could possibly explore. But I do think that that's an important thing to point out here, that it's not, certainly the state needs to take the lead on, as Madiha had said, you know, trying to seize the narrative and develop and propagate the right kind of narrative that pushes back against these nasty and hateful views that come from the hardliners. But there is something to be said for society as well and the role that it can play. So, but in terms of very briefly the long-term strategy, you know, I think that TLP is not going anywhere. It's here to stay, at least for now. And I think that, you know, at the end of the day, the government and the civilian leadership, the army, they don't want these groups to be out on the street risking, if not causing, actual internal instability and unrest. So that's something to keep in mind as well. So very delicate dance that the prime minister will have to carry out in the weeks ahead.
You know, this is such a great debate, and I hate to say that we have to conclude this discussion very soon. Ahmesha, are you still with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
I thought we lost you. So now RCBB is under protection. We all know that it's a short-term solution. So what is your thought on a long-term strategy? How can the authorities deal with this in long-term?
To be very brief, I'll just look back at the history because this law prevailed since the British, India's British rulers in 1860. And after that, when the military dictator General Ziaul Haq came in power in 1980s, so he inserted some other hard clauses in this law, which made it quite difficult for the liberals. And the case now, it is that all those people who have not committed the blasphemy, they are also afraid of it. I mean, the government is afraid to even defend those who have not committed the blasphemy. For example, the case of Mashal, or the case of Shama and Shehzad, the couple who was killed in 2014, and the case of Asia Bibi, who was acquitted by the Supreme Court. So now it's quite different than 2017. In 2017, when the TLP came out on the streets, so the PTI, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, and also the Pakistan military was accused that they even supported, somehow they financed them in some ways, but it was only an accusation. But now at the moment, the Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf led federal government, the Pakistani military, the Pakistani judiciary, these all three are on the same page. So it is a good move for them to end these cases for all. And in my opinion, the best way is to come out on the media, and the media can play a great role in it, and they should involve the Islamic scholars or the religious scholars in it. I mean, I don't say that now it is time to change or amend the blasphemy law, but at least they should defend those people who are wrongly accused of the blasphemy, who have not committed the blasphemy and they are accused. So at least they can defend it. And also the state can play a great role in this case, because in South Asian countries, religion has been used as an instrument to gain the power or to remain in power. So they should not support those radical groups or the religious parties who wants to promote the extremist narrative. At least they should leave them, and they should stop their way in the society, and they can also involve the universities, the debates, and the curriculum somehow. And then they can get rid of extremism or radicalization or the mob lynching.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
if just, you know, just to reiterate, this is a, that's a really important point. The fact that the blasphemy law is vulnerable to misuse in Pakistan. And that is one place where the state can step in. And in this case, you know, in Asia Bibi's case, it did step in. And so that effort from the state's side, you know, deserves to be lauded.
This actually happened in 2012 to Rimsha Masih. The girl was said to be 12 years old. This happened in Islamabad. Yes. You know, she was accused of blasphemy. And later on, it was discovered during the investigation, the Hafiz Muhammad Khalid Chishti, who had accused her of blasphemy, was guilty of desecrating the Quran himself, and he had tampered with the evidence. And I think he was arrested. He was jailed, but I don't think anything happened to him. And the girl, even after having been proven innocent along with her family, had to go into self-imposed exile in a Western country. And Chishti, because he was the good Muslim, had no shame and fear even after falsely accusing, a huge sin as per Islam, a girl, almost a child. These vigilante justice obsessed elements are all around us. They're everywhere, and they're not just bearded men that you see in these pictures. They are in schools, they are in colleges, they wear Western clothes, and you know, they speak English and they study in very good universities, and many of them have these views. And it's going to be a very long process, but things have to change, even if it takes a long time. Just the debate on blasphemy law has to start. They can't repeal the law, but they can start punishing people. And they said that they would do something about it, but that's the thing. Talk is cheap, and nothing really happens. And they know this is the main thing that has harmed Pakistan more than anything else.
Yeah. Thank you, Meher. Just a final point, maybe Madiha. So it has been a long-standing issue, but Bibi's case got so much attention, and it put this issue on such a spotlight. If one thing good coming out of this discussion, what is this? Also, is there any way government can use this spotlight towards the solution of this issue? I'm just really trying to end our discussion with a positive note. So, yeah.
I think the Supreme Court decision is a monumental decision. Yeah. And that's the first thing. And then I would say that the Prime Minister's speech, seizing the narrative, framing it in Islamic terms, defending the judgment, and telling the protesters not to engage in wreaking havoc on Pakistan's streets. And then, sure, you know, signing an agreement, but then engaging in a crackdown against them and having them be largely quiet. I mean, I think it's a significant step. It's not where everyone who wants a progressive Pakistan wants it to be, but it is a step forward compared to the past. And so for that, I think that we should sort of wait and see where this goes, but be cautiously optimistic about it.
Right. Okay, thank you very much, Madiha Afzal, author of the recent book called Pakistan Under Siege, Extremism, Society and the State. Meher Tarar, journalist and pro-government commentator based in Lahore in Pakistan. Ahmed Shah Azami, editor of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberties, Radio Mashal. And Michael Kugelman, senior fellow and deputy director of the Wilson Center's South Asia program. Colleagues, thank you very much for your time in touch today.
Thank you. Terrific discussion.
Thank you. And this is it from me, Mohammed Tahir, host of the AFPAC File, a joint podcast of Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and the Wilson Center. Please join us in the next discussion in 2 weeks. Until then, bye-bye.